3CR's Turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
Today's program, Not the Same, Culturally Diverse Women and Violence, takes its name from a conference held in 1996, which focused on how violence impacts differently on women from non-English speaking backgrounds. We will consider how problems of access, wider community attitudes, and government policies can contribute to a higher incidence and severity of violence for culturally diverse women in Australia. On the program, we will also hear from women internationally, speaking about the violence experienced by women as a result of conflict.
One of the things that happened immediately after the coup was an increase in violence against women. The number of rapes, for example, increased markedly. For example, in the first 4 months after the coup, the number of rapes were the same as for the previous year, for the whole of the previous year. And that was a concern that the women's movement had, that the increased militarization, the environment of violence, etc., seemed to contribute to this increased violence against women, both rape as well as domestic violence. Violence had been given a kind of legitimacy after the coup.
That was Shireen Lateef speaking in 1990 about the repercussions for Fiji women of the 1987 coup. Later in the program, we will hear more global voices speaking about violence. But first to Australia, where in 1996, Hannah Asafiri and Adele Modolo spoke to Women on the Line about the impetus for the Not the Same conference.
The reality is that no culture is any more or any less violent than any other culture. Violence is about gender abuse of power, violence towards women, and that occurs across cultural backgrounds. However, the manifestations of violence need to be responded to within their diversity and need to be responded to appropriately. Unless there's an appropriate early response, you will find at the end of the continuum a higher representation in domestic murders.
That figure, that statistic of 48% of those homicides occurring against non-English speaking background women, what we're trying to say is that the reason why that figure is so high is because immigrant women aren't getting the services at an early intervention point or at a point within that situation of domestic violence where she can actually take some action. It's very important for non-English speaking background women for community attitudes to change about their cultures so that their cultures aren't stigmatised, that they're not represented as super oppressed and victim-only women who are unable to take action on their own behalf. If they're resourced, if they have the information, they can take action. Absolutely crucial that we don't lose the hard work that women have put into the Women's Refuge program till now and all other services that have contributed to making violence against women manageable. However, on a more sort of idealistic level, instead of having to have refuges where women go after they've been beaten or after it becomes unbearable for them to stay at home with their partners or fathers or brothers, we need to look at ways of changing the way that people think and changing the level of tolerance of violence against women in general. When I'm talking about violence, I'm talking about it more broadly. Even it's not only against women in their homes, it's against women in the streets. And that's particularly relevant when you're thinking of immigrant women at particular times in our history. When they're trying to access the education system, when they have to learn back about their cultures, for example, in a really distorted and disgusting way. It's a really broad understanding of what violence is. It's not only about men who hit their wives and partners, but it's also about a broader society response to women when they try and just basically live their lives and survive.
This time the injuries were so bad that I think he got scared that I might die or something. He drove me to the doctor's at the after-hours clinic. He sat with me while the doctor looked at the injuries. My husband speaks much better English than me. He works and gets to mix with Australian people, so he has learnt the language. He does not let me go out to work, so I am very isolated and find it hard to get a chance to learn. The doctor asked my husband what had happened. He must have lied about it because the doctor kept smiling at my husband and looked at me as if I was some fool who had done this to myself. I wasn't asked if I wanted an interpreter or even if I wanted to give my side of the story. I was sent home with a man who could quite easily kill me the next time.
We refuse to hear judges who say it's in your culture to be violent. Go back to your culture because we're not going to give you protection. And we refuse to hear governments who say again and again to refuge services, we don't have the money for non-English speaking background women.
Why, when we come in this country healthy, do we after a few years become less healthy than the average white Australians? Why?
Being an immigrant or a bicultural, bilingual person is something which can sometimes be understood only when experienced. And would she not feel her communication limited, no matter how well she learned her second language? Because some very deep emotional themes can only be expressed in one's native tongue.
In Australia, people seeking asylum are held in immigration detention while their claims are processed. Juliana Nkrumah from the Australian National Consultative Committee of Refugee Women spoke to Women on the Line in 1994 about the impacts of this process.
If a woman or anybody goes through the determination of refugee status processing interview, that person is faced with one important question which says, do you have any marks on you that shows that you've been through this sort of suffering that you claim you've been through? Well, that is very humiliating for a woman, especially if the assessing officer at that point in time is a man and the woman has been through rape, which a lot of the women have been through, and other forms of torture. That woman being asked that question is going to really be thrown totally off her gear and be reminded of unpleasant things that she does not want to remember. And that is why it's important that the women be interviewed by assessing officers who themselves are women. And not only that they are women, but they are sensitive women. Depression is a huge problem for women in detention centers, just by virtue of the fact that a woman who has been through torture and trauma and rape and all sorts of problems that accompany the whole refugee situation has fled to a country like Australia that promises freedom. And for that woman to be thrown into a detention center, the process of just being caught, targeted, and being called an illegal immigrant or an illegal entrant and being thrown into a detention is enough to cause depression. Then in the detention, she's isolated and she's not allowed contact with the outside world. That increases the isolation and that gives rise to a lot of depression. Then in that situation, she's reminded of whatever rape or whatever isolation she experienced in detention in her country, and that doubles up for the person. Even being an asylum seeker outside detention gives rise to huge potential domestic violence problems, and being in detention doesn't make it any better. In fact, it worsens the situation. Being cooped up in a little place where all you have access to is a compound in the detention center, you cannot go outside into the main society, you have very little telephone contact with people outside, and there you are with your spouse alone, and probably she's the only person who speaks your language. That would just give rise to domestic violence. It's a big problem in the detention centers.
As we all know, since September 11, some politicians and the media prompted the rise of racism and prejudice against migrants. Many people's lives have been affected by that trend, and they feel under pressure in many areas of their life. The government cut funds that were helping migrants to settle into a new life. We all know what asylum seekers experience and what conditions they have been kept under in detention centres. The government is headed on a track for all immigrant refugee people in Australia, particularly women, to lose their own identity.
I find it quite hard and a bit annoying not being able to express your culture well, because no one would really understand what you're trying to do. There's not many people you can express it with. And in Lebanon it's so easy because it's just there. You know, you can contribute to it. And Here, you can contribute to it, but it's still not the same. People will still look at you and say, what is she doing? Or what was she talking about? I've never heard that before. Kind of thing, you know, I mean, probably sometimes even laugh at you.
Occasionally, a person I just met from school or something will come up to me and ask me what nationality I am. And when I tell them that I do have an Arabic background, when I decide to mention it, they have an expression of hesitance, mainly because of the media. I mean, the way it portrays Arabic women, and they come up to me and ask me, are you oppressed? Do you have to cover your hair and body? Or, and I find it quite strange, but I seriously think that the identity of women, Islamic women portrayed here in Australia, is very limited.
Three of the guys in my class, they said to me that, Rana, where we can find girls that we can ask them whatever we want with no money to pay? And you know exactly what I'm talking about. Talking about sexual things, you know. And one of them, he jumped up and he looked at me and smiled. And he said, you go to any Arabic country, you know, they're crazy. They're stupid, actually. Women do whatever the men wants to. And actually, I didn't know what to say because I was shocked. I was embarrassed. They were only talking headlines, you know. They said it's a joke, but it's not a joke.
Nada Rudi organised the first National Muslim Women's Conference in the early 1990s. Here, she talks about how women won't be bound by cultural understandings of Islam that go against their own readings.
For Muslim women, obviously, their interest is to be given the opportunity to get out and say, this is how I feel and this is how I interpret Islam in terms of relating to domestic violence or in terms of having your voice heard or participating in the affairs of the community. Obviously, to some sections of the community who have an agenda of trying to prevent women from participating will obviously feel uncomfortable with that. For those that are really committed to women's issues and they see their liberation and effective status of women as reflected in Islam, would obviously feel very proud to have women get up and say, this is how we feel and we want to reassert our rights on the Islamic way. I guess that is our biggest dilemma, that there's obviously two streams. One which is essentially Islamic in terms of behaviour and in the ideal and wanting to go back to the ideal and see your strength in that. Whereas the other one is that you find yourself being pulled away by cultural and, you know, traditional way of doing things which really not consistent with Islamic way. But I think Islam can't be responsible for the behaviour of those men who have for a long time, for centuries, been told this is a way of doing things. They feel a threat, which is a universal problem I think women feel all over the world, that if you give women an inch, I'll take a mile, and you just have to sort of keep them under control. And there's a lot of cultural beliefs all over the world with that particular notion. I don't think Islam can be responsible for that. In fact, Islam came to educate and to get rid of those attitudes, which really impinge on, you know, the community's development and the individuals within it.
You're listening to 3CR's 40 Days of Radical Radio Special, celebrating 3CR's 40 fabulous years of community radio.
The war killed a lot of kids, and because I'm a mother and have kids, and probably people who doesn't have kids feel similar to me, I want to remind people of this type of love, which can be against the war and against killing.
There's a great deal of pain and suffering in these stories, but at the same time an incredible amount of strength and courage that comes through. And I think it's that strength and courage, the capacity of survivors to speak out and to share their experiences with others, has an enormous potential for moving people towards change.
Now we move on to hear stories of violence from outside Australia. In Afghanistan, the Taliban regime imposed an oppressive version of Islam which sanctioned violence against women. Dr. Nouria Salehi, coordinator of the Afghan Refugee Women's Network in Australia, spoke to Women on the Line in 1999 about how the coming of the Taliban had severely altered the lives of Afghan women.
The Afghan women in the 10th century, they could go and follow the Quranic and also the language and literacy program at home or abroad in madrasa. But they lost it when the Taliban came in power. Taliban doesn't want the women to go outside of their houses and follow the education. Talibans are against education for women. And it's not that something religion, because in our religion, Islamic religion, is for education for women. And it was for education. And they encouraged people to go and be educated, that you can educate your children. So and our prophet's wife was a businesswoman. She was working. So you see, imagine 14 or 15 centuries later, and Taliban comes and they say, look, women can't move from their houses. And if they do, they will be abused. They will be beaten by Taliban. Even they are not allowed to speak or defend themselves. So you see, it's not the religion thing. It is just the stupid idea of Taliban that women should be stay at home. And why it came at this point? Because in the first 8 or 9 years, Afghanistan lost 1.5 to 2 million of men, young men, brothers, fathers, or sons. So at that time, women came out and they started working. And they were very successful on their jobs. So the Western world started talking about women, Afghan women, that they can be asset for their country. And the future asset of Afghanistan will be women. So I think they were afraid of this point. So what they did, they wanted to destroy them.
Nimaron Prudhatorn spoke to Women on the Line about her work to counter the exploitation of young women and girls in Thailand's sex industry.
There are some women who voluntarily come to this career because they have no alternatives. But the problem is the women who are forced physically, they were locked up. They were told lies like the agents. They just come to the villages and told the parents that these girls will have a good job with a good pay in the rich people's houses, and they will have a job like in the restaurant. They will get good dresses and everything. But once when they pay the money yearly, it's kind of yearly contract. The money come to the parents. But when the parents have got the money, these girls will be sold from one hand to the other hand and from province to the other province. These girls are likely to be locked up in many brothels. They may be beaten up, they may be raped again and again for many months until they get used to it. I mean, until they have no hope. And then they just see themselves like, now I have nothing to lose. Why just go for it? Many, many hundred cases become just like this. This girl run from 10 to 16. And in our organization, I'm working for the Friends of Women group. So our group have feminist lawyers try to work out on the law. Like we have a rape law. The rape law means that men who have sex with female children under 15, these men have to be punished by the rape law. But in the sex industries, the girls just after 10 years or up to 16, they should be protected under the rape law as well. But the police turn blind because they thought that this is a business. And they also get some bribe from the brothel owners. So women groups try to convince the government, try to push the government that the law is there, please implement it.
In 1990, Pema Deshan detailed how nuns in Tibet had been targeted for violence.
Physical abuse, especially to the nuns, because I'm a woman, I'd like to talk about particularly of the abuses on the nuns. Though, of course, the torture and oppression is on all our Tibetans, especially the ones who are put in the prisons, and many are put in the prisons because they don't really need to be much reason to be imprisoned. Just carrying a Tibetan flag or shouting for Tibet's independence or having the picture of the Dalai Lama is enough for them to be imprisoned and tortured. But then as for the nuns, as the nuns who come out of Tibet tell us, they are mocked for their very celibacy because the nuns are not married. And so what they do is, the moment a nun is arrested, it's most likely that she would get raped. Then there are certain peculiar ways of torturing the nuns. I'd like to relate four of them. One is stripping them naked and then making them run here and there and then they would let loose the police dogs. And as the nuns do that, the Chinese police authorities would just laugh and jeer and mock at the nuns. And then also one nun that had come to Dharamsala, India recently had lost her hearing, all because she says that in the prison where she was put, almost every half an hour in the first 3 days, she has been poked with cigarette butts on her face. And then, of course, slapping and beating is the most common method. And then also the nuns had the experience of getting electric rods put in their private parts and then in the mouth. And then sometimes they were even made to just lie on the water, and then logs of wood would be put on them. And then they're made to stay there like that for the whole of a night. And so the nuns have been treated worse than other women and men.
During the violence that followed East Timor's independence vote in 1999, Luca, an East Timorese woman living in Australia, spoke to women on the line after being evacuated to Darwin.
I was evacuated on Monday morning by one of the first Hercules to Darwin. I was forced to leave. I wanted to remain with the people for the fact that I'm Timorese, and I felt like a coward running away from the most needed people. For the last 7 days of my stay in East Timor, there was a lot of shooting during the night and all day, but it got worse as the sun went down. There were most of the Kora is all pro-independence people living in there, and the area was completely under attack and fire from the militia as well as the Indonesian military. I saw a number of trucks constantly going into the area and going out of that area. Also, I saw military on motorbikes as well, and a large number of militia on foot as well as on motorbikes and trucks. And the killing continued for all those days. By Sunday morning, I managed to get across the road into three areas of Bekora. Now, just looking at some of the houses in that area, together with some of the locals, we counted a total of 77 bodies, women and children as well. And some of these children were thrown into burning houses. I was completely devastated just watching it and being helpless. The militia made up of a lot of the poor people in East Timor, because they are giving food as well as a bag of rice at the end of the month, and 15,000 rupees cash. Now, a lot of them are also forced into joining the militia, because if they don't, they will be killed, or their families will be killed. If they do, they are forced to do this kind of act, because the military is right behind the militia. I've seen with my own eyes where the militia missed a few houses. The military then went after and finished them off, finished the houses off, like burning and throwing grenades into them. And that is the worst atrocities I've seen. Also part of the militia, there are a lot of Indonesian military dressed in civilian clothes, the so-called police dressed in civilian clothes, mixed in with the militia. And these are the ones that usually carry machine guns with them. And they will machine gun the people that, after being hacked by militia, still alive, or those who survive and they can see, they will machine gun them down. The international community have a responsibility to act to stop this horrible genocide going on in East Timor. Australia especially, and other Western countries that have supplied ammunition and financial support for the Indonesian military over in the last 24 years, I hold them responsible, and I ask them to please act now. It's not too late to do something. Act now. East Timor does not need diplomacy. Diplomacy does not save the people of East Timor, but action. We need action, and we need action from the military, action from the peacekeeping forces now.
South African grassroots feminist Susanna Ngubane visited Australia in 1997. 3 years after South Africa's first free elections were held following the end of apartheid.
A lot of scary stuff is coming out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We are hearing some of these people telling the commission about how they slaughtered our people. where they buried some of our activists. They are now saying that, yes, we did kill them, and this is where we bury them. The issue of black-on-black violence, that was not true. There was never a black-on-black violence in our country, but the violence was perpetrated by the government trying to kill all the democratic forces. And we found that the whole world was just made to understand that, oh, it's the black people fighting against one another. That wasn't true. The people, especially the black people who are killing other black people, were being paid by the apartheid system. I still find it very difficult to listen to people who slaughtered our people saying to the relatives, I'm very sorry, but it was an instruction from above. It's like they don't see anything wrong. They don't see how much damage they did in the country.
Three CRs turn 40, and from Monday, 10th of October, right through to Saturday, 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
You got wings. In the middle of the bottle is a little of the way you talk. And you shine, you shine.